Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to InForum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. Tonight, science and religion. Can't they just get along? Or are they fighting over the same turf? Turf being what's true and what's false. I'm Joe Quirk, your moderator. A rabbi, an astrophysicist, a biologist, and a theologian walk into a bar. Tonight, we're going to learn the punchline of that joke. Michael Lerner is the rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue in San Francisco, and editor of Tikkun Magazine. He's also the author of The Left Hand of God, Healing America's Spiritual and Political Crisis. And he's also the chair of the Interfaith Network of Spiritual Progressives. George Smoot is a professor of astrophysics at UC Berkeley, author of Wrinkles in Time, and winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Physics for taking a picture of the universe when it was effectively 12 hours old, going a long way toward confirming the Big Bang. Joan Roughgarden is a professor of biology at Stanford University and author of Evolution's Rainbow, winner of the 2004 Stonewall Prize, and she is also the author most recently of Evolution and Christian Faith, Reflections of an Evolutionary Biologist. And Robert Russell is the founder and director of the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences and professor of theology and science at the Graduate Theology Union, Berkeley. He has a PhD in physics and is founding co-editor of Theology and Science. And he's also the author of Cosmology, Evolution, and the Resurrection of Hope. Please welcome our panelists. Dr. Smoot, the only thing that made you more famous than winning the Nobel Prize was a throwaway phrase. It's like seeing God. That got you in the tabloids. Your name appears on creationist websites. If you were using God in the rhetorical sense of atheists like Stephen Hawking, do you, as a scientist, have a responsibility to choose your inspired language with a sense of its social implications?
That's a nice lead-in question. As I was saying, I actually gave a press conference that lasted about an hour, and that was one of the very few phrases in it. I was using it in a sense to convey the implications of what we had seen about the early universe and about the implications for creation and for what would happen after that. And it was something that a lot of the reporters who were unequipped for were able to understand and then write to their, readers and so forth. And, of course, one of my colleagues said, I wish the hell he hadn't said that.
Oh, so you didn't see God?
Well, I didn't say that. But I would make a statement here at the beginning that I find kind of strange because I find myself coming down exactly on the same side as the Vatican, which is that in a fundamental sense, there could be no conflict between science and religion. If you think that God created the universe, then studying the universe you see, they have to be in agreement. And the Vatican comes out very much in that way. They have their own observatory. They have their own science section. They have conferences to keep them. They learned from their experience with Galileo. And you can get, they learned that in the end, when they thought it through, their statement is that they have nothing to fear from truth, right? Now, well, the reality is that there are conflicts between science and religion, and that's because of the human element involved in both. And I'm sure we'll get to that.
Well, at the most basic level, Daniel Dennett says that mind, meaning, and purpose is not the cause of the universe, but the relatively recent product of the universe. So scientific evidence requires us to perform this mental inversion There was never meaning or purpose until brains evolved to invent those things. So do you agree with that assessment, or do you want to stay out of it?
I actually think it's a really interesting thing to debate, and I think we'll end up debating it because they're related things. The first question is consciousness, you know, a separate thing, or is it part of the machinery of the mind? And then it comes to the question, is there a soul? And then is man the only animal that has a soul? How does that all fit together? How can you put, you know, how does it all go? And in the end, what is the meaning of life, right? And those are the questions that come up, and you can say, studying the physical causes and everything will never give you the meaning of life. It'll only tell you how it all fits together. But the questions of consciousness and the questions of issues of souls, those are things that become central in the debate between science and religion.
Well, Rabbi Lerner, you've been very eloquent about the spiritual need that's not being fulfilled in modern American society. Is there necessarily a conflict between science and religion? And if there is, where do you think it is?
I don't think there's a necessary conflict between science and religion. Science as a procedure for studying the physical universe, or that aspect of the universe that we have decided to call the physical universe, is a perfectly legitimate and important and valuable enterprise that we all ought to support and not impose any agenda on it. But there is, alongside science, in the past several hundred years, there's grown up a philosophy, a worldview. In fact, I would argue it's the dominant religion of the Western world, that I call scientism. And scientism is the attempt to take the scientific method and apply it to aspects of reality for which it could not possibly have any application. That is, for the aspects of reality that are non-repeatable, non-observable through empirical data, not subject to measurement. So I include in that ethics, aesthetics, love, consciousness, many other aspects of our actual human experience that will never be subject to or appropriately subject to science. But what happens is with scientism is that scientism has attempted to imperialize the world of knowledge and say that there is only one kind of knowing, our scientific knowing, that there is only one way of validating knowing, namely the kind of evidence that we have acquired in science, and that scientism is a religion. That is to say, its fundamental premise that all that is worth knowing can be known through the methods of science, and that everything else is either, as contemporary champions like Dawkins and others have said, some form of illusion or delusion or whatever, that's a position for which there is no measurement, for which there is no observation, for which there can be no conclusive experiment. In other words, it is itself a religious perspective that presents itself because it uses scientific language as though it were science. When it's not science, it's the religion of science, scientism, that is quite different from science. And yes, there's a very strong conflict between that religion and the religion of other folks that don't accept the dominant religion.
So scientists are always insulted when their field gets called a religion.
Right, but I didn't say that. Remember that I said a strong distinction between science and scientism, because I'm a strong advocate for science and want to see it deepen its understanding of the world and continue to develop in all the knowledge that it can accumulate. But that's very different than scientism, which is the attempt, well, I've just described.
Yeah, you've already described it. Yeah. Dr. Roughgarden, you're an accomplished biologist with over 120 papers published in academic journals. Yet in your recent book, Reconciling the Bible with Evolutionary Theory, you said DNA is like a mustard seed, and I've heard you compare the bonds in a diamond and coal to the bonds among people. Can't we make metaphorical relations among anything? What's unique about your analysis?
Well, the position that I was coming from when I wrote the book Evolution and Christian Faith was as an evolutionary biologist and dealing with the need to teach it. And I took as a starting premise that there simply are people who are religious. And there have always been people who are religious. And the question is whether evolutionary biology is inherently hostile to people of a Christian tradition. And so therefore it was really important to explain what evolutionary biology was using language and metaphors that are already found in the Bible. And in fact, a number of the key ideas in evolutionary biology must date back to the dawn of agriculture, and so therefore find their way in the Bible as well. So the notion of natural selection turns up in the parable of Laban and his relationship to the master and to his master. The farmer Jacob in relationship to his master Laban and the breeding of cattle and sheep. And it's completely laid out there in that particular chapter of Genesis how a stock is bred and how natural selection takes place. And the notion of random mutation has always been a very problematic area for people who are Christian. And I pointed out that the notion of the spreading of mustard seeds across the crowd and is very similar to the notion of random mutation that biologists have in mind. So that if you draw on passages in the Bible, you can show how evolutionary biology is not inherently hostile and is not an expression of scientism. And so this is really important if we're actually going to get evolutionary biology taught throughout the country and in communities in which there's a strong Christian traditional and fundamentalist emphasis. And so that's the value of going through those particular metaphors in that case.
Well, I can find metaphors in Shakespeare for animal husbandry and breeding animals and breeding sheep and things like that. Why shouldn't we go to any literary text and find metaphors that relate, the metaphors of evolution in those texts? Why did you go to the Bible?
Well, the people who study Shakespeare are not complaining about the teaching of evolution. And so if they were, I think I would comb Shakespeare's writings to find that even Shakespeare clued into the whole idea. And so it involves the need to actually access the primary text from the spiritual tradition.
All right, Dr. Russell, I have a theological question for you that you've encountered before. My wife survived a struggle in her life through a deep faith that God had a plan for her. And I can tell you the day she lost that faith. When the tsunami struck Thailand, she saw a man on TV who lost his wife and all 10 of his children. And I know enough about your life's work to say if Dr. Russell was there, he would help. And if Dr. Russell didn't help, he wasn't there. So why can't I use that reasoning to say God wasn't there?
Well, because God was there. God was there in the struggle, in the suffering with that family, and offering eternal consolation to it. It doesn't justify the evils in the world, but it does say our best hope is a God who redeems the world. If there is no God, evil is still there. And then evil is unanswerable, and all the injustices of the world can never stand in a court of law, an ultimate court. Our best hope in the face of evil is that there is a God who is just and loving and will transform ultimately all into paradise.
Because I can't help noticing that the belief in a God satisfies all these deep yearnings to belong, to never die, to be reunited with our loved ones. Just because our soul yearns for those things, does that mean it's necessarily true?
No, of course not. That's why Feuerbach and Freud and the whole team of atheists were able to argue that this is a projection or a neurosis or a power play or whatever else. It could be that. There's no proof that it isn't, but there's also no proof that it is. And I'd rather stake my life on the faith that God does exist as a compassionate God that Jews, Christians, and Muslims worship than give it up and face a brutal reality with no hope of redemption.
All right, we're being very polite. Let's throw a hand grenade into this discussion. I want to start a Jerry Springer brawl among these scholars. An academic paper published in the Journal of Society and Religion, Gregory Paul, a social scientist, analyzed a whole boatload of data from Gallup and other surveys to compare standard signs of health among developing nations. And his conclusions are astonishing. He reports, quote, "In general, higher rates of belief and worship of a creator correlate with higher rates of homicide, juvenile mortality, STD rates, teen pregnancy, and abortion in the prosperous democracies." And the study also reports, and I quote, "High levels of organic atheism strongly correlate with low homicide rates, low poverty rates, low infant mortality rates, low illiteracy rates, as well as high levels of educational attainment, per capita income, and gender equality." And then I found another study. The FBI released the crime statistics in 2003, and scholars jumped all over them and analyzed them and found that within the USA, red states lead the nation in violent crime, divorce, unwed mothers, incarceration, drug addiction, and alcoholism. So both nation by nation and state by state within this country, strong correlations can be drawn between the level of religiosity and social ills, and strong reverse correlations can be drawn between secularism and signs of social health across the board. So though we know correlation is not causation, why shouldn't a guy like me look at this quantitative data and say, wow, the best thing we can do to create a healthy society is eliminate faith? So who did I anger the most? Rabbi?
Well, as you say, correlation is not causation. And I think that there is, particularly amongst the liberal and progressive world, which I am proud to be part of, and have been the founder of this organization, the Network of Spiritual Progressives, but there is amongst the liberal and progressive world a certain amount of what I call religiophobia and disdain for anybody who is religious or spiritual, and a sense that actually that we who are not, those who are not religious or spiritual, are in a higher level of intellectual or psychological development than the rest. And I think that the way that you are presenting it reflects that kind of attitude. And I think it's a deeply mistaken attitude. Let's take the issue of higher levels of, in red states, of what we say, divorce and...
Divorce, all the right. Measures of social...
Yeah, right. And the question is, what's the causation here? Yes, when people are more beaten down by the economic marketplace and the ability of ruling elites to eliminate alternative forms of organization for people, for example, in those same states, there are very low level of union affiliation and very low level of connection to social change movements. When that happens, and when people face the marketplace, the economic marketplace, with its bottom line of materialism and selfishness, with its definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality confined to how much any institution maximizes money and power and does not include love, kindness, or generosity, when you live in that society, the more you're subject to those dynamics, the more pain you are in. And yes, the greater level of pain, the greater likelihood that people will seek forms of alternative ways of dealing with that pain. And some forms of religion that I find offensive, namely what I call the right hand of God in my book, The Left Hand of God, that is, forms of religion that call for domination and power over and control are presented to people as their alternative. I think it's wrong for people in the who have a different consciousness or who understand the possibility of a world of love and kindness and generosity and peace and social justice to look at the people who are in that situation and say, ha, 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 you've got a higher level of pain there. You're in more trouble. You've got more divorce. You've got more AIDS. You've got more all of these problems, but instead say the opposite. Of course you've got these higher level of pain. That's why you're driven to these irrational forms of spirituality. We need to provide a rational form of spirituality or a more loving and kind and just form of spiritual understanding and a social a vision of social change, of justice and economic and political justice and peace and kindness and generosity that would provide you with a way to not have to go to the most reactionary forms of religion. So instead of being elitist put-downers of others who are in pain, instead see that their response, grabbing on to these forms of reactionary forms of religion, is a response to a deep level of pain that they are in, for which the appropriate response is caring, not cynicism and put down.
So, Dr. Russell, good answer. You and your foundation have worked hard to open a dialogue between scientists and people of faith. Are there physicists and geneticists out there who are saying, boy, this is a thorny scientific puzzle? Perhaps I should knock on the door of a theologian.
Well, I think as several of the folks in the panel have said, it's not a matter of theology informing science about science. It's a matter of theology learning from science about the world God's created. Now, it might be that some of the ideas theologians have about the world might be interesting and helpful to scientists individually. Well, my classic example is Fred Hoyle, who was a devout atheist. And he was so angry at the evidence for a Big Bang that he actually created an alternate theory, steady-state theory. In fact, he actually changed the laws of gravity from Einstein's general relativity to a C-field cosmology. So he created a new theory of gravity. Out of it, he got a solution for an expanding universe with no beginning, the steady-state model. And for 2 decades, it was more or less empirically as adequate as Big Bang. So the point is that he, as a person of deep faith, namely an atheist, was able to translate that because of his genius into a view of the world which was consonant with it. Steady state didn't prove atheism, but it did show that it's possible in some cases for the inspiration from a living world religion can be efficacious in other parts of culture, not just economic theory and political theory and psychological theory, but even the natural sciences.
So you quoted Pope John Paul, science can rid religion of superstition, and religion can rid science of false absolutes. So what are some of the false absolutes that religion can liberate science from?
Well, as Michael Lerner said, scientism. The idea that science is the only route to truth, and therefore if science can't talk about it, it doesn't exist, it's not true. And that's one of the most clear forms of hubris one can think of, and Rabbi Lerner said, that's making a religion out of science. And I think it's important for us to simply name that as a kind of form of idolatry and say, look, if you want to do it, fine, but that's what you're doing. You're not doing science. You're putting a philosophical gloss on science and elevating it to the form of religion. And know what you're doing and then decide if that's what you want to do. Well, and similarly, I think it's the first part of the Pope's statement is very important. The first step is for theologians, for people in the churches and the synagogues to recognize the way in which they cling on to, outmoded views of the world and of human nature, and to recognize it as a kind of superstition and to denounce it. So we need first to clean up our own act. And in the process, we might be helpful to our colleagues through mutual respect and learning to help them see new insights into their own work.
It seems to me that God has become a synonym for mystery. You know, first God's explained why the winds blew, and then we explained that, and then God's explained where the earth came from, and then we explained that. And now God is tucked inside the first squintillionth of a second after the Big Bang. And it makes people like me wonder if scientific ways of finding truth are just going to keep pushing God further back, keep taking territory from these kind of religious spiritual beliefs. Is that a wrong way of thinking about it?
Well, I would just say that, yes, it is. Well, I mean, I think it's expanding.
Yeah, I have to argue a little bit here because
it's expanding the domain in which we can talk about God.
If you look at the history of what's been going on in human thought over this time, you had the situation where religions were explaining just how man fed in the world and how things behaved, and then you had the Greeks and the rise of the philosophers and the ethicists and so forth, and then you had what we call the modern religions come up. And then 400 years ago, we had science come up. And in each of those phases, people looked to the primary intellectual contribution that was going on to explain the whole world, to explain how they fit in the world and what went on. And sure, they had God for the wind, right, before the Greeks became more naturalists and philosophers. And we had that. And there's a lot of other things that get explained. Religion does more than just explain, say there's a God and there's a this. There's this console. You know, when people are sorrow, you know, gives them hope, you know, gives them consolation. There's a lot of things that religion does besides provide a moral, you know, overlay. And what you find is that as science has developed new technologies, a lot of your daily life has been taken up, right? Mm-hmm. The load has been taken up and the explanations have been taken up, so that the roles that religion was playing are diminished in certain areas but strengthen other areas because the modern life is a different style. And some of the conflict we see is that readjustment going on, and some of it's historical, that people sort of have this idealized view of what the ancient way religion operated was, and they're expecting it to continue in that sort of form. But there is the issue that you brought up, which is as you explain more and more, you find you have less and less need for God. And so back to your question to Lerner, that, you know, how come it is that certain modern democracies, particularly in Europe, where people have come up with a fairly homogeneous society and they develop pretty well, why are there so many more people who are basically, you know, doubting the existence of God? It's because they don't need it in their daily life. Mm-hmm. They're not in a situation of stress. They're not in a situation where they're called upon to see God. They've seen that most of their needs are taken care of and socially and by the structure that's there. And so they look around and say, do we need a God or not? And the answer is less so. It's not that they just don't still need human contact and other aspects, but they don't see the same need for God that people who are under you know, great duress do, that are seeing their lives ruined or terrible things happen. They need to hope that there's something that gives them immortality and a reason for why everything's happening.
I mean, I'm certainly glad to see that kind of advance in Europe, in which, although I would remind you that it came on the heels of Europeans engaged in a world war that destroyed some 60 million people. And wars, by the way, the major wars in the 20th century, the First World War, the Second World War, the Vietnam War, the wars of countries to free themselves from Western imperialism, now the Iraq War. None of them fought for religious reasons. All of them fought on behalf of ideals of secular countries with secular goals and so forth, killing over 140 million people in the 20th century. So I don't want to yet say, oh, well, this great advance, you know, see, we got rid of God, and boy, did they get to a higher level. Furthermore, I want to say that I'm glad that we're getting away from the conception, and I think that this is what's happening in contemporary theology as well, at least Jewish theology, or at least my part of Jewish theology, getting away from the notion of God as a cosmic bellhop that is there waiting to intervene for us to make things work out if we just throw him the right, or now her, throw him or her the right lamb chop, that's how it used to be in the older times, and now the right set of words, and she will, if we say the prayers right or whatever, she will intervene in this world. I think that it's a good development that theology has moved away from that conception of God and is much more concerned about understanding the sacred in other human beings, understanding the sacred in the world itself, in the physical world. And there, we have to, again, challenge scientism, because the dominant religion of the West, which I'm calling scientism, has been one which has done an abysmal job of taking the scientific advances and applying them in ways that are in the interests of humanity. Instead, although there has been a huge increase in material well-being for some, there is actually tremendous suffering on the planet on the one hand, and on the other hand, an ethos of endless growth that is destroying the planet. and that will eventually undermine the possibility of human life here. So I wouldn't be so, let's say, celebratory about what has been done with science any more than I am celebratory about the ways that religion itself has often been misused in destructive and hurtful ways.
Dr. Roughgarden, you have something you want to say?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment, if I might. I do think we're being a little overconfident here about the capability of science to produce information that will sort of unilaterally inform theology. And the way you posed the question was, would a scientist ever go to a theologian and ask for, say, an alternative hypothesis? It's not the wind, it's God, you know, or something like that. And that really obviously isn't fair. But what would be of some interest is whether or not people of faith can inform the way science is being done. And I've pointed out in the past that we're dealing with, at the moment, a kind of homogeneity of the people who are carrying out science. And at any one time, science progresses by real human beings actually generating hypotheses. And if you imagine that there's a space of all possible hypotheses that could be generated about a phenomenon, you have to get people who will actually gin them up, who will actually make this suite of hypotheses. And at the moment, particularly in my field of evolutionary biology, we are being coerced, if you will, by people who are advertising nature as the place or the arena in which solely selfish activities take place. The idea is that if you go walking in a park and you see two birds singing to one another, what are they really doing? Your average evolutionary biologist will assert confidently that they are lying, cheating, and stealing from one another. Do you really think that two birds singing to one another are lying, cheating, and stealing? Right? And so that's the issue. But we don't at the moment have a cadre, if you will, of evolutionary biologists who are entertaining the possibility, even entertaining it, that the reason the birds are calling to one another is that they are actually building friendships which will let them work better together and raise more young and leave more genes and offspring for the next generation. The whole notion of an evolutionary theory which views friendship and cooperation as a first-class theoretical principle is just not being developed. And therefore, and this is a reflection of the homogeneity of the ideology of the people doing science. And so I think it's very important for people of faith actually to get their hands dirty and get into science and take an active role in generating a suite of hypotheses that are not currently being put on the table. And then they can be checked out in the good old regular scientific method. But we need to get the right a sufficiently rich set of hypotheses generated in the first place, and there's a real role, I think, for people of faith in that activity.
Well, can I just come back to your Joe and your point? I think it's unhelpful to look at it as competing domains. When science expands, religion contracts. I think it's much more helpful to see how they can inform each other, and so that the expansion of knowledge in any field is helpful to all fields of knowledge, where knowledge is genuinely sought after.
Well, people like Richard Dawkins and Matt Ridley write pretty eloquently about the evolution of cooperation and sincere affection, and we know that prairie dogs die for those they love, and as far as aesthetics, I'm sure a fly finds a pile of poop very beautiful. Dr. Roughgarden, are you not satisfied with the biological theories for the evolution of cooperation and love?
Oh, yeah.
Noble sentiments?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not satisfied. And that's because the biological theory for friendships and altruism are of two types, something called kin selection, where you basically help your close relatives, and another kind called reciprocal altruism, which is basically the idea that I'll help you if you help me. And both of these are basically workarounds, which are intended to show that the cooperation and the altruism is just an illusion, that in deep down, the individuals in question are selfish. And they're achieving their selfish goals by manipulating or teaming or shacking up with someone else. Well, and that is a problem because we know that that doesn't satisfactorily explain the breadth of cooperation that's actually observed in nature. And that means that biologists have to, as scientists, own up to the fact that those two theories for the evolution of altruism and cooperation are inadequate. And that then means we need a bunch of people who are prepared to actually generate a set of hypotheses that are more comprehensive than those we've been living with since the 1970s. And so Dawkins, the selfish gene, for example, from Dawkins, was really written in the 70s, and it was a popularization of G.C. Williams's critique of group selection at that time. It was a very nice phrase, the selfish gene. He's really a master, as you know, of the soundbite. But this is 30 years later, right? And it's no longer credible to try to advertise the selfish gene as though that was still the appropriate defining concept in evolutionary biology for cooperation.
And it's really the popularization of the marketplace. And yeah. In other words, human beings do science. And so their understandings of the world affect the hypotheses that they are willing to explore and the formulations of the data that they have uncovered. And so when you live in a society which for 300 years has been indoctrinating everyone to believe that it is, quote, human nature to be competitive with each other and to look out for number one is the common sense of the society, and maximizing self-interest is seen as the only rational way to be, then it's not surprising that those hypotheses find their way into the way that scientists growing up in that same society decide to organize the data that they've come to and reflect the dominant ideology of the society in which they live.
Right, and we have to do something about that.
I fear that this might be a mischaracterization of what evolutionary biologists are really saying. I mean, Dawkins himself is rabid about, you know, selfish genes can give rise to selfless organisms. He's talking about selfishness on the gene level, and you've probably heard of Axelrod's tit-for-tat experiment that shows that cooperation can evolve among replicating computer programs in certain parameters. And these are arguments for how sincere love and things like that can evolve. If you look at most of these guys, I don't think most of them would be characterized as liberals politically, and to say that they're internalizing a capitalist ideology and putting it into their science.
They definitely are. And sorry about that. And I mean, what you see, the whole notion of the selfish gene assumes that actually the real issue is individuality. And the selfishness is really an epiphenomenon of allowing the individuality to be the issue. And Dawkins is writing on this, for example, is very critical of the notion of the body. The body, right? And you might wonder why would anybody be critical of that? And that's because the body is really viewed as just the expression of what comes out of all of these genes. And so you imagine all the genes are on a big a string of beads, and every little gene is a bead. And so what you are is simply the sum of what is produced by all of these things. Now, of course, they'll acknowledge that different beads will interact a little bit in the production of the phenotype and of the body. But the point is that the locus of action is at the whole body and not at the gene, because it's the whole body, which is the package, which is exposed to the environment. And it's not only the whole body as an individual, which is important, but actually the collection of individuals. So when you have a pair of birds, take a robin's nest. Robin's nest, for example, is not the production of the genes of any one of the robins, but of the pair of them. They had to have a relationship, and then together they build the nest. And so Dawkins, for example, will talk about the urge to build a nest is genetic. Sure, the urge to build a nest is genetic, but the nest itself is a product of the relationship that was built between the birds. And so this whole notion of the selfish gene really is mistaken because of its celebration of individuality. It's pushing individuality down to the atomic level. And that's where it's wrong.
Okay. Dr. Russell, what's the first step we can say? What's the first step we can take to get science and religion to work together to create a society of peace and love?
Well, I think it's what a lot of folks have been saying already, to recognize that science is done by scientists and religion is done by people who also are informed by science, and to recognize the limits of those disciplines. So that even if a scientist is speaking as a scientist, that's fine. But if she's speaking as a philosopher or as a theologian, then to challenge it at that level and say, how, in what ways are you using your science to better the human condition? What ways are you using sort of implicit philosophical arguments, reductionism, scientism, to undermine the human condition, to help separate out the science from its misuse? That's probably the biggest problem with intelligent design, is they take science to be the enemy, and so they try to change science instead of taking the atheistic use of science. And the same thing for the theologian. We're the first to need to be challenged in our sort of glib move from theological philosophical analysis to the use of outmoded cosmologies, outmoded views of the human person, outmoded views of reproduction, outmoded views of creation of life. Look at the stem cell research issues where Christians debated by importing Aristotelian or middle age concepts of the human person instead of contemporary concepts. So an awful lot of clearing of the ground and of humility on both sides is needed to see when we're stepping outside our professional bounds, but using the expertise of the professional bounds to authorize non-professional statements.
So when Dr. Smoot said, it's like seeing God, was he stepping outside his professional bounds?
No, not at all. I think it's a celebration of the human spirit to recognize the astonishing beauty and compelling joy of creation, of nature. And that's what he did, and I'm grateful for it. I think if he'd taken that and then developed it into a sustained argument, as Sagan or Dawkins or Dennett does, that somehow it proves God, then I would be very cautious, just as I'm very skeptical of Pope Pius XII, who said Big Bang sort of proves God. So I think it's wonderful for us to celebrate the human spirit in any form of language we have, including religious, aesthetic, metaphorical, But that's how I read what Dr. Smoot did, and that way I celebrate it.
Well, Richard Dawkins, everybody's enemy tonight. He writes really.
He can take it.
Yeah, I know.
It isn't Dawkins; it's what he says that's the enemy.
So can you, Dr. Roughgarden?
You bet.
Well, he writes really poetically and unweaving the rainbow about the awe and wonder provoked by a scientific satisfaction of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And whereas he says religious explanations of the universe to him are provincial and paltry and can't compare to the sublimity of the scientific explanation, and that the way the world really is seems to consistently be more awe-inspiring than what we imagine it to be. So is it possible that our ethical sense, our awe, our love of beauty are going to give way to scientific explanations that are more satisfying than ancient explanations? Anybody?
Do you mean that awe and wonder are themselves the reducible to a set of scientific criteria, scientific facts, such that one could, if one knew enough about the universe, predict that at such and such a moment that your brains will fire in such and such a way as to lead your mouth to say, I am in awe?
That's the pure materialist. That's the pure materialist viewpoint, okay, which is almost the philosophical viewpoint. But we experience those things without a sense of spirituality or believing in a God or
Joe, my sense is that the God that Dawkins attack is not the God I believe in. He characterizes these 2,000-year-old monotheisms with petty images of the God that we worship and then rejects it. Well, and I would be the first to reject it too. But the God that I worship is the creator of that astonishing universe that's 13.7 billion years old and that led George to say, I see the hand of God in it. Well, yeah, that's right. So in fact, there's a nice coherence between these two.
Well, where I start to lose my faith is the further we move God back into the Big Bang, the more I'm looking at the way the world evolves and the way wondrous creatures like us get created is through a great deal of suffering and death and fear. And you and I spoke on the phone, and it just seems like a large part of how evolution works is this gladiator arena where cheetahs eat antelopes and antelopes are running from cheetahs. It starts to not look like a universe made by a benevolent, loving God.
But is that an accurate account of what's actually going on in nature? So you've assumed, basically without further challenge, that is what's going on in nature, that it's nothing but nature, red tooth and claw. And that's what you see on Discovery Channel. And so what I'm pushing on you is whether or not, that's really true. That is certainly what you would read if you read The Selfish Gene and extensions of it. But is it true? And so it almost clearly isn't.
Yes, there is sublime cooperation going on in nature, but there's also a great deal of suffering.
Yeah, but which you want to emphasize?
Well, also, what you're wanting to do is to put God as responsible for everything that's happening.
Yes.
And right, and that's how you read the tradition. But there are others who read the tradition, or at least have evolved an understanding of the religious traditions in a different way that doesn't have God intervening at every bad moment and to cause all the bad. There's a sense of God as giving a certain amount of dignity to her creation, and that dignity allows for a self-development that is not intended at each stage by a God who's sitting there and pulling the strings. So in that self-development, that the way the universe evolves and the way animals and human beings evolve is in part a product of something else besides God's intentionality. Now, what you want, see, here's the thing, is that so many people who are into the scientism, not science, but scientism, want to say that the only real religion is the one that I can't stand and the one that I can refute. And this is the point that you were making before, that there's a different conceptions of God that are evolving, or different understandings of the spirit that are evolving, that do not reduce God to being the cosmic puppeteer who's responsible for each development in the universe. Now, if you want to say from that, and therefore I can't praise God for all the good in the universe, fine, you don't have to praise God for all the good in the universe, because even in the old religious texts, for example, the Bible, it says God is creating human beings in God's image. And part of that image is giving a certain level of freedom. And we're seeing the evolution of the world in such a way that greater levels of consciousness, greater levels of freedom, and greater levels of cooperation are emerging in the world. But that process, the more freedom, I mean, anybody who has ever had a child knows, the more freedom, the more unpredictability, the less ability to control. But at the same time, the greater respect that you can have for the other. So to the extent that God has made it possible, or that God has participated in the evolution of freedom and consciousness and cooperation by creating beings that could work in that direction, God can't also be in control of it. And if God can't be in control of it at every moment, then she doesn't deserve the blame for everything that we're choosing.
We're going to take your questions in just about 2 minutes, so please start lining up by the microphones. So when the tsunami took that guy's 10 kids and his wife.
Yeah, where were human beings in that? Where were we in the tsunami? What did we do in terms of destroying the natural cycles of nature such that we get something like the destruction of New Orleans? Instead of asking where is God, that's the answer that people give who don't want to take responsibility for our collective action in impact on nature that has been a destructive impact and that hasn't really created circumstances, including psychological circumstances, in which we would all be there helping and taking care of people in suffering. So next time ask not just where is God, but where is humanity?
Because I think we just reached a consensus between the people of faith and existentialists, the best of whom say humans have to take responsibility for what happens and forget about God, whereas people of faith are saying don't blame God for bad things happening. Are there any questions from the audience? Nobody's lined up? Yes, sir, come forward.
Hi, thank you guys very much for speaking. It was excellent. But my question is specifically for Dr. Smoot. And this is my question. Earlier, there were mentions of like scientism and issues which we are maybe unexplainable today, such as love and consciousness and things associated with the sacred. But there's a possibility that these things, albeit unexplainable today, could be explained in the near future using the scientific method. And my question to you is, do you think that there are issues today that are unexplainable, love, consciousness, which in our lifetimes will be explainable? And if so, what do you think the next place will be where people start to question, kind of like, where do you think the postmodernist deconstructionist will go and say, well, you now can't explain this?
Right. So there are a lot of things that we are sufficiently sophisticated and difficult that we don't understand them right now. You hear a debate about sociobiology, about the selfish gene, which I think we characterize a little sloppily here. But the
I agree.
The fact is there are loose ends in simple genetic theory, although we've made impressive progress over the last year in spite of what, on a technical level, where we know that 99% of our genes are the same as chimpanzees, and we know there's huge long blocks of genes that are the same in all, you know, all animals and so forth. And there's a number of things that we're learning that are really liking, you know, really sort of tying down evolution as an important aspect. But there's a bunch of things that are still too, you know, the loose ends. But there are a bunch of things that are even much more complicated than that. That is, what do we really mean by intelligence and wisdom? What do we mean by consciousness? And so I think the next really big area that we have to sort of, that will yield and people will pay attention to is that question of artificial intelligence and of consciousness, right? And then it'll be longer before people worry about love and souls and other issues like that. But consciousness is very sophisticated kind of thing, because in fact, as we study humans, we find out that they make a huge number of mistakes. That you learn in school two kinds of reasoning. One, which is your everyday life reasoning. When you're driving a car, you're not making careful calculations. You're doing memory rote kind of actions. You're making quick decisions. You're doing that kind of stuff. There's only a few times when you actually multiply numbers together and sum things up and follow procedures. That's the rational kind. And so there's a certain kind of thing we find that where people just make mistakes over and over again, but and it's a very slow learning process, and they get it. And so that comes down to the issues that we come back to when we start talking about religion and so forth. Where do we get our divine knowledge? We get it from writers in the past that wrote it down. Now, the problem is we know that brains fail, right? They make mistakes all the time, and yet somehow God had to intervene and give the message to the writers of the Old Testament or whatever, whichever book you're wanting to. And so you have to say, well, what about the translators? Did they get it right? And so forth. So you start having all these uncertainties and questions and this kind of thing. So understanding intelligence and understanding the prejudice that people bring to science and the people bring to religion is going to be a key next step. And then there'll be things after that that we'll have to mm-hmm. pursue. But we didn't really get into some of the fundamental conflicts that are going on between science and religion, just because they're fairly technical kinds of issues now that have to do with what is the right approach. And we have a set of people here who are fairly liberal and fairly sophisticated in their view of what religion should be. And there's nobody here who says that if you pray properly, God will answer your prayers right away. You don't hear that. You're hearing the back off. We're having this. The kind of discussion was, well, there's either the God that's kicked the universe into being, or there's a God who's intervening at a very subtle level all the time, but hidden into the laws of physics, so that when we run our airplanes or drive our cars around, it works just fine, right? That we don't need God to turn us right and at the corner and so forth. And so there's a lot of subtleties that are involved in our thinking now, and that's because we're in a modernly sophisticated city compared to, you know, some places you could go to where people have a much more subtle, you know, they don't have the same subtle appreciation. They have a more direct and personal God who they think is intervening with their personal life on a daily basis.
I'm from San Diego. I know. Yeah.
No, I mean, and we have the same issues in science. We know in this panel, we don't have anybody here who is a scientistic person who is going to say, as many, many people have through the last several centuries, science will save us. Science will provide progress is the answer. That we will, there isn't anybody here who doesn't recognize that science has no ethical guidance to offer us about, for example, the use of science. That when it comes to the question of whether science should be used to create nuclear bombs or whether it should be used to create more and more products and use up the resources of the planet, science has nothing to tell us about this. So luckily, we've got some scientific modesty here as well as religious modesty here, and both spheres deserve and need that kind of humility.
Okay, next question, sir. Yes.
I had two comments and one question for Dr. Smoot. The first comment was what Rabbi Lerner just said about humility. We evolved from the primates, and our bellicosity runs very deep. And as we've gained more power technologically and socially, I think our hubris has increased even more so. And I think one of the tragedies for us, and perhaps a reason why people seek God, is when we look at life forms on our planet, every brain that developed is less complex than ours. The animals can't produce complex societies and arts and sciences and technology. So we have no proof, we have no evidence of a more complex life form, a more intelligent life form, a more compassionate life form. And I think that's our quandary, is until we ever discover that, if we ever do, our temptation to be so proud and arrogant is going to always be present. My second question is, I don't think we'll ever really know whether consciousness or matter came first. It's really hard to say that, well, consciousness just evolved from matter. I don't think it's that clear. And finally, I have a question for Dr. Smoot. How sure can science be about, A, the age of the universe, 13.8 billion years or so, and be sure that this explosion that happened because of the black body radiation and the other evidence that points towards the Big Bang, how do we know that this Big Bang wasn't localized? It was just part of our universe. And since we don't have the technology to observe the entire cosmos, how do we know the Big Bang encompasses the entire cosmos? Thank you.
Okay. So I don't know what to argue with first, but let me do the third, which is it is true that we can only see a limited part of what we think the whole universe might be. We can see only as far as light kind of travels since the beginning of the what we call the beginning of the universe, or at least the end of the of what we call the Big Bang. Not to say that the universe couldn't be expanding and doing other things in other locations, but we can see roughly 14 billion light years in any direction, which is a pretty big volume. But the whole universe we expect is much, much larger than that. And there might be, additional volumes in which other things are going on than the kind of space we're in. So the answer is we can't be sure yet. We have to, continue our researches and look for other relics and other pieces of information about the early universe to give us hints about, how much more there might be and how much more complicated it might be. And, that's...
Can we take a question from the most curmudgeonly person in line? We only have like 5 minutes left. Okay, you.
So it seems pretty clear to me anyway that the sciences articulated by the panel could work together with the religion as articulated by the panel. But the religion that you're articulating doesn't seem to me to be the religion that most people in the United States practice. So the majority of people in the United States believe that the world is 5,000 years old, not 5 billion years old, and that evolution is a false theory, and that Christ will return during their lifetime. So how will science and the religionists as practiced in the United States ever reconcile with each other?
Well, that's a great question. I think you're right. If you take your, quote, sacred texts literally, you've got a problem. So if you take either the Bible or the scientific texts in a literal sense, yeah, you have a conflict. And so thank you for the question, because a presupposition of this conversation is that we use texts in a much more subtle way. Trying to be responsible to the original source, to read the Old Testament literally, is to understand what the priestly tradition meant when they used Babylonian cosmology to reaffirm faith in Yahweh, not what the King James Version means. So you're right. We need to do diligence to those texts, or to listen to George Smoot and see the subtlety in Big Bang cosmology and many worlds theories, and not simply ontologize them that they're right, nor to dismiss them because they sound kind of scary, but in fact to deal with those texts that are scientific texts in a much more complex and responsible way.
There's any realistic hope that will happen in our lifetime?
It's happening now. You're right that the majority doesn't do it, but it is being done, and that's what's important, because it's a new venture. This new venture of a dialogue and mutual interaction is really quite new, 50 years old.
Right. I was going to try and be quiet, but I can't. I got to say something, which is the previous questioner. Whoops.
That's okay.
Said was saying we're the smartest things around. You know.
Yeah.
I will bet you in 50 years we're not even close to the smartest thing around. Some of you may have seen the movie I, Robot, right?
Yeah.
To give you a choice. I think it's a race between artificial intelligence and between genetically modified humans on who's going to be smartest, fastest. But they will be a lot smarter than the current people in less than 50 years. It's just no question that technology is going to exist to modify humans and to modify robots to the extent that they can do better than we can.
If your notion of smartness does not include some element of ethical consciousness. And that's exactly one of the problems of living in a scientistic society where smart or intelligence is defined in ways that have excluded ethical consciousness and spiritual consciousness from the discourse. That kind of smartness made it possible for the scientists of Germany to efficiently wipe out as many Jews as possible, 6 million of them. There's a question about what the meaning of smartness is that cannot be answered by science.
My time card person appears to have been sucked up into heaven and the rest of us are left behind. So I have no idea how much time is left, so I'll let you do one more question.
Thank you. You just made a statement, Rabbi Lerner, that science can't know. How do you know? You stated that science can't determine these things.
Right.
How do you know? Dr. Russell called it extreme hubris for that scientism, as you call it, states that it is the only way to know things. And yes, there are some rather obnoxious people that make that claim. But I don't know any really good scientists that do.
Because there's no ethical judgment
for
which there is any.
How do you know?
Well, let him answer your question.
Well, I'm saying there is no ethical judgment for which a scientific experiment has ever been relevant to proving it to be either true or false.
So that says that we haven't done it yet. Not it will never be.
No, it's in principle impossible.
How do you know that it's in principle impossible?
I think you've made your point. And please give a big hand to our panelists for their thoughts here tonight. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Inforum is adjourned.